Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and with me, the Fortean researcher, writer, and artist, Red Pill Junkie. Man, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about the Kunil case and just how, man, this is just a really strange case.
It is serious, Rob. And beforehand, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk about UFOs, and especially to have a chance to talk about these sort of cases, these high strangeness cases that are often overlooked by people in the United States, I guess, because of the language barrier or other considerations, like the idea that the Americans still feel that the only cases worth investigating are the ones that happen in their own country.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely the broader view is the better view. The more complete picture you two have of everything that's going on, the better. Yeah, so, were you the first person to write about this case in English?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't claim to say that. I'm sure that probably people like Scott Corrales, with his blog Inexplicata. Scott has been writing about Latin American and Hispanic ufology for years and years, even before I somewhat entered into the Fortean blogosphere, as I call it. So I don't know, maybe in Scott's blog there's something about the Kunil case. But yeah, I decided to write about it for Mysterious Universe because it was so difficult to try to compete with the likes of Nick Redfern. You know, you had Nick Redfern and Micah Hanks and all the other guys writing for MU, and I was like, oh my god, so what can I write about that these guys haven't even touched? And I remember, the Kunil case, because I stumbled upon it when I read Juan José Benítez's book, La Quinta Columna, The Fifth Column, which is a book he wrote in the 1990s, that it is exclusively about close encounters cases with humanoids that happened in Spain. It is a fantastic book. Unfortunately, Benitez's books, as far as I know, have never been translated into English. I don't know what keeps. I mean, in the 21st century, come on. But, well, that's the case. So that I decided to, like, okay, I'm going to be like the emissary for Mr. Benitez, and I'm going to write about it for the MU audience. And that's why I wrote that two-parter article, The Night of the Humanoids.
Yeah, and like I think the best way to describe this case is it almost seems like the introduction to a sci-fi horror film in a way, just in like it's almost like an invading force in a way. It shows up and it has the ability to change itself and to blend in. So that was the first thing that came to mind, is like sci-fi horror film. This would make a great premise for a sci-fi horror film.
Right. Yeah. I think I remember comparing it with this graphic novel, this comic series, Marvels.
Yes.
That was illustrated by Alex Ross, because what they did, him and the writer, I think it was Kurt Busiek, was that they grabbed these classic stories from the Marvel universe and everybody knows about, like the Fantastic Four's battle with Galactus and the arrival of the Silver Surfer and the death of Mary Jane with the Spider-Man and all that, but they decided to put it in the perspective of an outside bystander, like the humans who are watching all these gods fighting, and they don't know what's going on. They don't have the advantage of the comic book reader, who has like almost like a godlike vantage point and a narrator explaining the situation. Here, you don't have a narrator. You don't know what's going on. And I feel almost like that was the case with these kids when they were seeing these strange happenings before their eyes, like these entities coming to the beach, this Playa de los Bateles or Bateles Beach, out of the sea. And then they go and they sit on the beach in a very awkward position. They create almost like a wall of sand in order to cover themselves very poorly, obviously. I mean, why are they doing that? Almost as if they were putting on a show, right? And yeah. Then they have this transformation, like they get up and they have been somehow transformed into almost like normal looking human beings, except from the fact that they still kind of like stand out in a Spanish town in Cadiz. Like this, the male was almost 7 foot tall. The woman was also very tall, and the male had this very protuberant forehead with a very long hair. It's like, okay, you became human, but you know, there wasn't like a perfect transformation. And then they go inside the town to do who knows what.
Yeah.
You know? And apparently this is something that happened for a number of days. And in fact, has happened on numerous occasions, the sighting of strange entities in that particular town in Cadiz, not only in the 1990s, but also even in the 1980s, and also even in the 2000s, as we can discuss later.
Yeah, the area where this is, it's a Canillo de la Frontera, is it's a coastal town, basically. Like there's a lot of beaches. I just, from the little that I read up on it, it seems like the kind of place that you know, makes a lot of its tourism dollars just from like summertime beach stuff. So,
right.
And you know, I've seen pictures and just absolutely beautiful beaches and stuff like that. And the particular beach that we're talking about, Playa de los Bateles, is where this goes down. And I think what's interesting up front is we have four witnesses here. We have Pedro Sanchez, Isabel Sanchez, Pedro Gonzalez, and Lolly Bermudez, and they're spending time at this beach at night, and they see what is essentially what they describe as like a red moon, a very large object that's not at a particularly high elevation in the sky, but it's very distinct. And they watch this thing for like what, 14, 15 nights or something like that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously one will think that they weren't the only people,
right,
who had watched this luminous object. But they yeah, they were seeing this, and obviously, eventually they told their families, okay, we're going to go to the beach because there's this thing happening. It is strange, and this is something that maybe the skeptics will point out, that no one else, aside from the fifth witness, the little kid who was, I think, 14 years old, and no one else, no adult, accompanied them to see, oh, okay, what is this Red Moon nonsense you guys are talking about? It is kind of strange, but well, that's the story.
Right. These aren't exactly, you know, like teenagers. You know, you have some of them are in their 20s. The youngest one at this point, before the fifth witness joins, is 17. So, you know, they're definitely not in the youngish, like, gullible point that I would, you know, put, like, at least, you know, in terms of, like, unreliable witnesses, I don't think that they're that.
Yeah. It also reminds me almost to the first Mothman encounter.
Absolutely.
Except of the fact that, as far as we know, these youngsters weren't engaging in some kind of, like, frolic. You know. You were discussing the idea of a horror movie, and it's always the case in American horror movies
where
when the teens are in the lover's lane, and that's when the monster, the werewolf, strikes, you know, when they're not paying attention. Oh, Johnny, what was that? Never mind.
Absolutely. Oh, man. They would see this object. It would usually show up between like 8:30 and 9 o'clock at night, and it would usually depart by 9:30. And like I said, they watched this thing over, you know, 14, 15 nights, and they were looking at this thing through a set of binoculars, and they were able to notice that there were kind of like four white dots on it as well, and they would strobe intermittently on and off. But the culmination of this is on September 29th, 1989. And I think what's, you know, to set this up in a way is, like, this case doesn't really fit in with a lot of what was going on in 1989, at least in the UFO culture that was happening at the time, aside from Verones, which, you know, happened two days before this. So, you know, that's another one that doesn't really fit into the time period. But if you look at what's dominating, at least, you know, in the United States, it is abduction cases, because by this time, Communion has come out, Intruders has come out, and those two kind of really set the stage for UFO culture. Especially now, you have a lot of abductees coming forward, experiencers coming forward, and starting to share their stories. You have cattle mutilations, which is big. You have in 89, I believe that is 89 the year that Bill Moore kind of, you know, exposed his deceptions. Okay.
Yep. Move on.
Yep. So these stories, this and Verones, definitely set themselves apart from most of what is going on in the UFO world, which I find just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, you're right. The witnesses did not observe the typical gray-like entities that by then had become like the dominant archetype of the alien entity. These are very strange, tall entities with very round white heads with no discernible features, and wearing these robes that were so white they appeared to be almost like glowing, and they appeared to be almost like they weren't floating. On the contrary, they had very jerky movements, almost as if they weren't able to bend their knees. And then the other one, you know, the giant, the 10-foot tall giant with a pear-shaped head, which is kind of characteristic of other described humanoids. But the size and the stiffness of the movements and all of that, it is really, really something that makes this case stand out so prominently.
Yeah. On the night of the 29th, they add a fifth member to their group, Lazaro, who is Isabel's brother. And they would meet in the same spot every single night, which was it was in front of a bar called Los Corrales. And they were usually stationed like, I don't know, a few hundred meters away. But on this particular night, as they add this one group, this one member to their group, things change. Instead of, you get the typical, the same object that returns, but like from the horizon, they see what looks like this like semicircle of white lights coming in from the horizon and coming towards them. And through the binoculars that they have, they can also see this triangular formation of red lights that's inside of it. And this light formation comes in over the water and it flies over their heads. It's almost like a kind of a signaling event that something weird's going to happen. After this formation passes, a third light appeared directly above the witnesses. At first, it looked like it was just another star. It was just really tiny. And then it flashed three times. And when it did, the red moon object that appeared every single night would respond with its own flashes, which is very eerie. And then this display lasted for about 30 minutes. Then all of a sudden, the attention of one of these one of the witnesses is drawn to these figures on the sand, and like you said, they're approximately 7 feet tall. They are adorned in these white cloaks that just covers their bodies, and I mean, their heads were described, they were basically featureless, if I'm remembering that correctly. Okay.
Yes, and
I mean, naturally, this unnerves everybody except for Pedro Gonzalez, who pretty much convinces everybody to stay. And it kind of reminded me of, and I know it's a case that has controversy cast on it, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of the Allagash abductions when the light appears in the sky and everybody's starting to freak out. But Chuck Racks in the back like, guys, it's fine. No problem. Don't worry about it. Everybody's starting to freak out, but Pedro's just trying to keep everybody calm. Another thing that they reminded me of, there's a couple of different beings that these that they reminded me of. One of them is the specifically in the way that they're drawn, the beings that Gary Wilcox encountered in Tioga City, like hours before the Lonnie Zamora incident. And it's the one preceding incident that I think, you know, pins the extraterrestrial stuff on Lonnie Zamora. It's like that valet first suggested, I think, in, I don't know if it was Passport to Magonia or another book, but it essentially interacts with these beings that, like, are completely covered from head to toe in this kind of luminous covering. It's white, and they communicate telepathically. They also reminded me of a case from Africa in 1981, the La Rochelle incident, in which a bunch of workers that were working on the La Rochelle estate, they encountered this, it was a globe of light. One of the witnesses had seen it initially up in a tree, and then it rolled out of a tree and it rolled across this property. It actually rolled up into a really high tower, and it just kind of had a mind of its own. And one of the main witnesses was a guy named Clifford Muchena. And when he went to go ring this bell to alert people to what he thought was a fire, he ran into these very strange, tall figures that were adorned in white. Their heads were luminous, and they just made him fearful instantly. He actually fell to his knees. So it's interesting to see kind of these archetypes in other cases. Not totally unfamiliar, but definitely still distinct in this case. the two beings then started to move in their direction at right. first. It seemed like they were coming towards them. And like you said, it didn't seem like walking was easy for them. It's like they didn't know how to bend their knees. And eventually, as they started to all now turn around and run away, one of them, I think it was Pedro again, stopped them, and they turned around and looked, and they saw that they were actually turned and staring towards the ocean.
Yes.
You know, which is almost more unnerving. At least if I were in that situation, I think I would be a little more unnerved by that. But the witnesses kept a safe distance. They were, you know, about 30 meters away or about 100 feet. And the events continued. This small white orb of light started to fall towards the beach where these figures were standing. And it stopped about nearly half a meter from their head. Mm-hmm. And it disappeared for a moment. And it was as if it was prompting them to do something. And it prompted them to sit down in the sand. They're sitting down, their backs are remaining rigid, and they start to scrape out this kind of like moat almost with their hands, which also adds to just the absolute strangeness of this case.
Yeah, especially because afterwards, maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but afterwards they saw the markings left by the beings after they departed the beach, transformed, and the markings in the sand indicated very, very long and very thin fingers. Mm-hmm. You know, something that wouldn't be consistent with a normal human hand, I guess.
Yeah. They watch these figures then lay down in the sand, which is lay down and the way you described it, it's like it was almost like a fortification in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And Pedro Gonzalez had been the one looking at things through the binoculars, you know, just keeping a watchful eye. And then he proceeded to just like drop them and start to run. And, you know, everybody basically tried to hold them back. And he says, there's a taller figure there, you know, right on the shoreline behind them. And at the time, they just didn't see this, whatever this tall, hulking figure was. But the way that you described him and the way that, because he will show up again and they'll see him more clearly, it's about 10 feet tall. It's wearing, it looks like it's adorned in all black, wearing all black, or it could just be, you know, all black except for its head, which seems to be white.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't see it at first, just by looking in that direction, but eventually this ball of light disappears. This small ball of light that's been had disappeared, reappeared around these figures. And all of a sudden, these strange beings that are laying in the sand are transformed into human-looking figures now.
Yeah, it's like a magical act, right? I mean, we don't know exactly how the transformation unfolded, if it was instantaneous or if it was like something out of a Hollywood movie, like in which they show you like the gradual morphing of the figure. We just don't know. We just know that the testimony of the witnesses is like when they stood up, not only the features of the entities had dramatically changed, but also now they were wearing normal clothes, like jeans and skirts. Like, what the hell? Where did they have that? Where was their traveling bag?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just, okay, cool. You're people now. I guess that's how this goes down now, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
I want to know what this tech is, because it would make things so much easier, you know, just like trying to blend in with your surroundings. And, you know, if you're in an awkward social situation and you have the ability to blend in, I want that technology immediately.
But is it technology? Rob. Yes. Because I know that my good friend and partner in crime, Joshua Cochin, would immediately, right about this time, jump in to the conversation and point out all the similarities with the fae folk glamour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the idea that the fairies were able to fool witnesses into thinking that they were of a certain shape, when in reality it was just an illusion. Maybe it's an illusion that is just done in the mind of the witnesses, or maybe it is something that actually happens in the physical. We just don't know. I mean, we have only a few hints that maybe it's just some kind of like illusion, because if I remember correctly, the footprints that were left by the humanoids, even after they were transformed, they were still very weird. They showed abnormally large feet with a very prominent, big toe.
Yeah.
So what's with that? You know, does it mean that maybe the witnesses didn't look correctly? Maybe they were so fascinated by the transformation that they never bothered to look down and see that the woman and the man had like really large freakish toes, almost like like goblins or something. I don't know.
Yeah. The footprint definitely, it looks like they just have one giant, enormous toe and a lot of foot. That it didn't look like there were a lot of toes, just one giant, massive, hulky toe. But the most interesting thing about the man, so, you know, he has very long blonde hair, kind of like a Orthon, like long blonde hair. And wearing jeans and this checkered shirt. But the thing is like his forehead is extremely long, and it's great because you compare him to Exeter from This Island Earth, and like that's a great comparison, because like I grew up with the MST3K version of that, and it's just so great. Interestingly enough, the woman, she had more Asian features. She was shorter, she had long dark hair, wore a blouse and a skirt, which was just very, very strange. But they get up, they lift themselves up from the sand, and they start moving in the direction of the witnesses. And they're walking in like a single file line. The male is walking ahead, the female is walking behind, largely because this male was taking greater strides just because he was so tall.
Yeah.
And they approached a dark alley right as they're about to disappear. There's like a small white cloud that approaches from the sea fast, and when it reached the shore, it evaporated, and these folks just kind of disappeared into the town. Right after this, the tall, dark figure appears near the shore. It's confirmed by Pedro. Mm-hmm. And this being is not standing. It's hovering slightly, which is even more off-putting, I would say. You know, you're tall. Do you really need to hover? I mean, that's... Yeah.
You know, it reminded me, I'm a big fan of the anime Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It really, the features of this being and the way it moves, it really reminded me of like the first angel, right? In the first episode of that cartoon series, like... These they are called angels in the series, but they are actually like alien entities that are so different from humans, and I mean it is so unnerving. I mean I think I would have preferred something like almost like an entity moving like the Hulk from the Marvels, right?
Yeah,
Hulk smash.
Yeah, this is definitely much worse. So the way that they describe its posture, it's very stiff, it's very rigid, it's not really moving much of its limbs, but kind of floating, and then it departs towards the west, and Pedro and Lazaro instantly kind of get this moment of bravery, and they start to chase after this thing. They get to within about 50 or 60 meters before they return to their friends. And they witness one more bizarre thing that night. They notice this bouncing light that just kind of...
Right.
How did you describe it? It was kind of like, you know, like on the TV where you see the bouncing ball.
Right, like the sing-along bouncing ball.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, but it was like bouncing around, I think, on the horizon or something like that. And then eventually it departs, but... When all this activity dies down, they run into a guy named Juan Bermudez. He's a correspondent for a local radio station. He joins the group. And, you know, having learned of their exploits, he hopes to catch a glimpse of this himself. And together, the location where the two figures had, you know, laid down in the sand, they found the trench. It was about 2 meters wide, 1 meter long, and... They describe the sand as almost definitely like scratched, like definitely kind of like raked with long, slender fingers. Mm-hmm. And they found a bunch of odd footprints. They measured about 18 inches long, 6 inches wide, and the one very big prominent toe and really large arches. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think maybe they could give Bigfoot a run for their money, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
Another strange aspect to this is that from the time that they observe these figures, you know, appear, sit down, lay down, get up and start walking, there are way more footprints than they thought there should be on beach at that time.
Yeah.
So that's another interesting feature to this.
Yeah. The moving in circles, I think, or something to that effect. And again, my mini Joshua Cutchin in my left shoulder is reminding me of all the fairy dances in circles,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That people reported in Ireland and all the other Celtic countries.
By October 5th, this story had kind of just hit the press. You know, there was a Spanish group of UFO investigators. They were known as GIFO. They started to conduct their investigation, and they were kind of quick to put a lid on this. Their determination was that it was a misidentification caused by, you know, overexcited imagination. The UFO was a British ship that was laying underwater cables for a telephone company. And they had been using like light signals to coordinate scuba gear, and they kind of did just like shoddy work on this. I think that's the one thing that when skeptics come to the table is like, if the burden of proof is there, your work probably shouldn't be as shoddy. You know, it shouldn't just be, hey, I made one phone call and found that there was a ship in the area at the time. But, you know, if you don't get the full details, it's kind of lazy skepticism there.
Yeah, exactly. It's trying to find the easiest explanation and often enough, Rob, they end up cutting their throats with Occam's razor.
Yeah, they just kind of dismissed everything as, you know, these figures were scuba divers that had appeared on land, which is kind of interesting that they had a change of clothes with them. You know, that's really great.
Exactly. Yeah. And according to the skeptics, they created that moat or sand fort because, I guess, being a man and a woman, well, they wanted to, you know, get jiggy with it, even if they know they are, like, not right near a public space, like that bar Los Corales that we were talking about. And I guess they didn't mind having the kids also near them. But just they created this fort in order to, you know, like cover the show.
Yeah, absolutely. GIFO released their report on October 16th, but the day before that, a guy named Jesus Borrego Lopez, who was a police officer. He was also like an amateur UFO investigator. He traveled to Conneal to figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he managed to track down all the witnesses. He's like, hey, let's, you know, he brings them out to a bar and he's, you know, just getting them drinking. And, you know, he's like, hey, let's go out there and let's see, you know, if we can experience anything. So they go back out to the beach, and around 10:35 that night, they caught sight of the strange shape-shifting couple. They made another appearance. You know, of course, the forehead of the man was the number one identifier of him. They follow them to see where they're going. They're doing their best to, you know, keep pace. And shortly after Borrego Lopez, Pedro Sanchez, all the witnesses had caught up, right before that, they had just like vanished into thin air. You know, like strange figures do from time to time. And then they noticed like a strange black object that was approaching from the water, and its movements were very erratic. You know, it was kind of like a push and pull kind of force. And then that dark mass suddenly became a human figure, a woman who was sprinting just very fast. Like, I think the way you described it is like, it reminds me of like cartoons growing up and watching like characters run like really fast. Their legs are just going, you know.
The Roadrunner and the Wile E. Coyote. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly like that. So this woman's sprinting. She pulls ahead of these witnesses. She stops like 60 meters from them and she just starts removing her clothes.
Yeah.
Okay. And then she starts to move away again. And then she's joined by two other individuals just out of nowhere. Like, the strangeness with this case is just, it's crazy. It's baffling.
Exactly. It's there are cases in which you get the idea that the encounter or the entities appear for the benefit of the witness, like I don't know, Betty Andreasen, Whitley Strieber. Okay, we come for you, and there is no doubt about it. Like the reason the entities are there is because of the witness or the abductee. But with this case, it feels like the witnesses are an annoyance to the entities. So they create these games in order to divert the attention. Like, oh, don't look over there. Look over here. You know, like, don't look at what's happening with the right hand. Look at happening with the left hand. Also, like a magician. So I don't know. So apparently, maybe because Borrego and the kids, they were thinking about maybe following or trying to find where the tall guy with a big forehead went, that the other, that like the sprinting woman, the roadrunner woman appeared in order to like say, no, look over here. And then after they were totally baffled by this, then the other entities appear, and I think by the end the man and the woman reappear and they return to town, and it's like, okay, what's going on here? Are they trying to put on a show for Borrego and the kids? Are they trying to divert attention to other things that were happening there? Because, the idea, okay, entertaining the idea. Yes, there are aliens, extraterrestrials, whatever you want to call them, that they're infiltrating our planet. Why would you do it in a tourist town? Why would you do it in a tourist town? You know, in a beach, in a public beach. At 9 p.m., why aren't you doing your walking shenanigans at 3 a.m.?
Yeah. Yeah, the intentionality of whatever these beings are, like, especially it harkens back to Pierre Fortunato's Amphreda and his encounter with the Dargos, and, you know, them saying, hey, we need a new home. You're going to be our emissary. We're going to give you this glass sphere or whatever it was, and you need to give this thing to J. Allen Hynek. And, we're just... we're going to get along peaceably. the strangeness is almost hard to wrap your head around, especially when it comes to like simple things like that. It's the absurdity of it. And like this gets into like what these people are experiencing on this beach, at this direct moment is beyond absurd. It's just, yeah, it almost defies belief itself to the point where you definitely had to be there. There's no way you could convince other people that this happened, but you know.
Yeah. And also remember that they actually had, I think it was a video camera with them.
Yes.
Or something, or a film camera. And they actually tried to film the man and the woman.
Yes.
But nothing came out of the film. I don't know. It was kind of like undeveloped or something.
Yeah. In total, in the time that they had observed the Roadrunner woman, she had traveled 4 kilometers or nearly 2.5 miles in 45 seconds. And let me tell you, I wish I could do that. That would be amazing.
Everybody wish we could do that.
Yes. Borrego Lopez, he examined the footprints and he found that the ones that were left by the woman were kind of barely noticeable. She didn't seem to be putting a lot of weight onto her feet. But the ones that were left by the man were, from his estimation, made by someone who was at least 220 pounds. So,
yeah,
definitely, significant difference there. The couple actually returned around midnight, and this time they were armed with the camera. The tall male figure shot Borrego Lopez just like the death stare. And I think, is that what you, because you created in the articles you wrote, you created the art that appears at the top, right?
Yeah. I wanted to, because it is so difficult to find, illustrations about this case, the ones that I did find weren't particularly appealing to me.
Yeah.
So I say, okay, what the hell? I'm going to do 2 illustrations for myself. And I did. I tried to do my best. And actually, I'm very happy with the way that I portray the male.
Yes.
Yeah. Annoyed and not particularly that. I mean, he's not like threatening. He's not like giving like, I'm gonna kill you. She's not like, you shouldn't be here. It's the kind of like message that I wanted to convey in his eyes.
Yes, he's definitely got the stink eye. You know, he's shooting the stink eye. Definitely the why are you being so weird about this? Like, there's nothing strange going on here. Just stay away. And then, you know, the woman, she said in the article said that she looked more nervous than anything. She so. They run into these figures and, you know, after they get that look, they kind of hang back and they lose them in the streets. But after the debunking, JJ Benitez, he comes a knock in and does he puts forth a great investigation. There is actually one case of his that I have covered, and it is the case of the man. He was only identified by his first name, and his first name was Henry. And he had encountered a strange man in South Africa in 1951.
Right.
Yes. On he.
I used just... that one, that case too, when I talked about my articles about Planet Umo.
Yes. Yes. Which is another really interesting it's an interesting, how do we put this? Because, like, you know, it's a very contentious subject.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think what's most interesting about it is that, you know, the Ummo case involves, like, a photo that's hoaxed.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That has a symbol underneath it. That symbol also apparently appeared on the craft at Voronezh. So, yeah. You know. We have that connection going on here, but
yeah,
JJ Benitez, he shows up in Kinneil and he starts his investigation, and he did find that there were two ships in the area, and one of them, the one that was actually laying cable, was a ship called the CS Monarch. And
yes,
they had been hired by a company called Telefonica to lay some lines. The work had begun in the area on September 18th. And it's interesting there because, like, by September 18th, they have already made four trips out there. And they have seen this reddish orange large object in the sky for four nights already. So automatically it can't be that ship. It's showing up a little too late. Not only that, but it's at the time it was working, you know, 60 miles off of shore. So there's no way that they could see it, given I think, like, the visual range from shore was about like 5 miles or something like that. In terms of the episode, the event on the 29th, it would have been impossible for a large ship to be in that area due to the low tides and the strong winds. So that was another jab that Benitez took at Gifo. Yes. And what's great here is that Benitez was actually able to, you know, contact the captain of the ship, a guy named J.A.B. Simpkins, who placed the ship about 30 miles away from Batalis. They weren't even in visual range for that.
Yeah.
Not only that, he wouldn't have had, you know, divers in the area either, but
there's another aspect that Benitez has managed to uncover in his investigation. The idea that he actually managed to find a hotel where two German tourists stayed in.
Yeah.
But then he made some inquiring, and it turns out that those German citizens had never left the country. And this is something that I want to point out now, Rob, now that we have gone through the core story of the Kinneil case, because I'm sure you're familiar with another Spanish investigator, José Antonio Caravaca, you know, who is a great guy. Everybody should follow him on Twitter, even though that mostly he tweets in Spanish, but, you know, he occasionally tweets in English too. But anyway, he sent me some time ago this article that he wrote for this Spanish site, El Ojo Crítico. It's a long, but it's a really, really interesting case in which he tries to show that at the time of this close encounter, or alleged close encounter, there were at least the involvement of the secret services of at least two countries, Spain and Germany, involved in that particular area at the time. And it turns out that, I mean, we were talking about how the skeptic were saying that all this was a case of misidentification because they were these boats, they were laying out this telephone cable under the sea, right? But Caravaca makes the point that there were spy agencies that were very interested in trying to put some type of interception devices on those cables in order to spy on those telephone conversations.
This is
something that was happening right about that time. And at least three countries were in dispute here. You know, there were the Spaniards, there were the Germans who apparently were in league with the Spanish. Let us remember that back in World War II, Spain and Germany were kind of like allies by the time of Generalissimo Franco and Hitler. And that apparently those ties remained even after World War II ended. And then there are the British, right? The British who are located in Gibraltar.
Yes.
And the British were none too pleased of seeing the Spanish and the German like teaming together. So in this article, and I'll send you the link after we finish recording this, so you take a look. I'm sure you can read it using Google Translate.
Yep.
He makes the point that he's not like trying to say, oh, yeah, those two beings, the tall blonde and the woman, were actually German spies. Also, he kind of like makes this soft suggestion. But he only wants to try to point out that while all of this was happening, there were all these Secret Service shenanigans going on. So to me, when I read this, it almost reminds me of another very popular case in the annals of ufology, which is, of course, Rendlesham. Mm-hmm. In the United Kingdom, because you have with Rendlesham, you have the true believers who say, no, there were actually UFO activity in this American British military base, and there were, you know, craft observed, and the craft somehow interfered with the nuclear weapons that were stored there illegally, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We have the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Holt. We also have the book Left at Eastgate, which of course is now mired in controversy because of the disputes between the two co-authors, Peter Robbins and Larry Warren, and all that.
Yep.
So there's that, and then there's the skeptics, like almost like the GAFOs guys, who are trying to debunk the case using the stupidest arguments, like no, the UFO was actually a lighthouse, the landing marks were actually like burrows left by rabbits. So it was all just a big misunderstanding. Nothing to see here. And there's the third wave of thinkers like Nick Redfern who suspect, well, maybe there was some other involvement. Maybe there was some kind of like secret experimentation with mind control techniques, maybe with some kind of like psychotronic weaponry in which the guards or the personnel that was stationed in this base were used as unwitting guinea pigs. So there's all this conflating, which makes the Rendlesham case so difficult to crack. And I almost feel that with Conneal, we get the same result. Like we have, the true believers, you know, Benitez defending the high strangeness of the case, and even Caravaca admits that yes, there's been multiple reports of beings aside from the famous one that happened in 1989, and there are obviously the skeptics we're discussing, but also Caravaca points out, but aside of that, there is this involvement because of the strategic importance of this particular area of Europe. You know, I mean, the area in which Europe and Africa almost touch, in which the Mediterranean ends, and the geopolitical importance of that area should also be taken into account. It's almost like, well, even we could speculate and say, well, maybe the entities were also interested in what was going on with all these, cloak and dagger shenanigans with the Secret Service intelligence. Maybe the entities were also interested in what was going on with the German and Spanish spies. Although obviously here, I am speculating.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, That's what this subject is. It's mm-hmm. speculation. It's all speculation. But I mean, exactly. Yeah, there is one other detail here that I think could definitely play into that, and that's the between September 27th and the 30th, there was a nearby military radar station that had suffered some mysterious malfunction. So
yes,
you know, basically anything that would come into the area at that time would be, you know, untraceable.
Right.
That could definitely also feed into both sides of that. Hey, aliens are visiting, or these beings are visiting. Let's just disable the radar. Let's make this easy. But like, yeah. You know, they seemingly, at least they seem to stick around for at least a few weeks. You know, I kind of hoped that at some point there's somebody that has to come forward and say, oh yeah, I you know, like maybe some, like, you know, store clerk or something like that is like, oh yeah, I waited on these weirdos and they had like strange requests and stuff like that, and yeah
and then when they tip me in like diamonds or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. But yeah, that is the Keneal case, and man, it's just, again, you know, having, you know, it's sandwiched with the Voronezh case. It's like, they're two very odd cases involving strange humanoids that are very tall and just very strange on their own, like the strange elements. There's strange elements in the Voronezh case, and like in which like witnesses described objects like disappearing and reappearing, like the being got out and then it disappeared for a second, and then it came for a couple minutes, then it came back, and then it pointed right. some wand at a kid and made him disappear for a few minutes, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, not disappearing witnesses in Keneal.
No,
as far as we know. But yeah, you're right. It's something that I actually hadn't considered yet. How the entities in both cases, Voronezh and Keneal, had that particular ability of appearing and disappearing. Mm-hmm. You know, either you know. I guess if we use the nuts and bolts analogy, okay, cloaking and decloaking using some kind of like invisibility tech, or maybe it's something far more esoteric than that. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it's all magic to us, man. You know, that's exactly what it looks like. It looks like magic to us, and it's kind of like my friends Scott and Forrest over at Astonishing Legends always talk about the Mothman Prophecies window, and that analogy of the window washer having that advantage, you know, that different vantage point because he's so high and you can see. You know, it makes you wonder, like, you know. Is it so much that they're so advanced, or, you know, what is it that gives them this vantage point? And these are cases that make you wonder, because one is definitely, you know, became more renowned. Actually, you know, I believe Voronezh actually had, you know, appeared in the New York Times. So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was like a small blurb in the New York Times about it. So it's interesting that, you know, these cases happen around the same time, but one gets a little more coverage than the other one.
Yeah. Like you said, you know, it's endless speculation about the idea of the capabilities of these entities. Sometimes it's very tempting to think of them almost like infallible gods. But then again, is it that they didn't count of having witnesses in that beach at that particular time, and that was kind of like, oh, you know, we missed that. Okay, like go to plan B, the countermeasures, you know, send in the giant. or was it all carefully, and this is something that Benitez speculates very heavily in his books, the idea that everything that these beings do is carefully and heavily orchestrated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like a stage play being put for our benefit. And maybe, you know, the main idea behind this is that implanting the seed of the idea that these beings have the capability to infiltrate our society, like we know, okay, yeah, maybe they are actually alien beings walking among us, unbeknownst to us. And this is something that we now know because of the Conneal case. Of course, this is something that only you and I freak out about because we're weirdos. You know, because the Conneal case, you know, didn't have like the impact of, I don't know, the Tic Tac, the Tic Tac case or something like that. And this, I guess, is something that Vallée points in his books. You know, the control system, how the best way to like slowly and gradually alter a society and try to like veer them into a desired direction is if you do it in a very clandestine way, you know, like from the bottom up instead of top down. You know, the top down is disclosure, the thing that UFO Twitter dreams about, you know, like the UFO landing on the White House lawn and this tall blonde with a huge forehead saying, okay, take me to your Joe Biden. And, you know, that will be it. But no, these beings weren't landing on the White House lawn. They were landing in this little fishing and tourist town in Cadiz, Spain, doing God knows what. But hey, 30 odd years later, we're still talking about it.
Yeah. We absolutely are. And there was a case that I recently covered. I think it was on a Patreon bonus episode of this South African couple that they were making a late night drive home. And they were basically escorted by UFOs for a great portion of their journey. So much so that it seemed as if at one point the UFO was kind of just like lifting the vehicle up and, you know, doing the traveling for them.
How nice of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There was at one point they arrived at one location to gas up and everything like that. And they had I think their journey was like another something in the neighborhood of like 288 kilometers, but according to their trip meter, they had only traveled 19 kilometers, which is, you know, nice. It saves on gas. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But during this event, there was an abduction kind of like event where the witness described this. It was kind of like a being that appeared in the back seat, and it brought him up into the ship. And he met these other strange beings, and he said that they would appear how he wanted them to appear. So he was like, "If I want to see a duck, I would see a duck. If I wanted to see a monster, I would see a monster."
Like, you want to see the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man?
Yeah.
I'll see the Stay Puft.
Choose a form.
Yeah.
But one of the things that these alien beings imparted to him was, we live on Earth. We live on Earth as doctors, you know, I forget exactly how they worded it, but they talked about all these like mundane jobs. And like, I think like, you know, one of them was like toilet plunger or something. It was kind of funny. You know, they're blending in, you know, good for them. If they definitely want to spend some time here, it's good for them to blend in.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine if you're a big honcho in Alpha Centauri and you think that is the greatest thing ever to have a mission on Earth and become a janitor. Like, yeah, you know, oh, you lucked out, you know, you're going to be a janitor. I'm just going to be another banker in Wall Street. That's, oh, okay, well, better luck next time.
It's like that. Have you ever read? It's a book by a Spanish writer, and I can't even remember his name. It's a book called No Word from Gerb. It's a very slim book. It's all about these two aliens that land, I think, in Barcelona, and, you know, they're kind of doing, you know, trying to see what the human population does. So the first alien, Gerb, he gets out and, you know, he sees what's going on and he decides, hey, I'm going to disguise myself. And who does he disguise himself as? Madonna. So, you know, I mean, blending in, not the best, you know, maybe not the very good at it, but, you know, give them a shot. But yeah, that's a fun little book.
Yeah. There's another case that you should definitely cover in your podcast is a case that Juan José Benítez is also investigated, and he wrote a book about it, and the title of the book is Ricky B. And it's the story of this woman that got hooked up with this wealthy Spanish businessman, you know, entrepreneur, and they were getting along fine. I mean, you know, young lovers doing what young lovers do, but the guy eventually got on nerve with the woman because she was so quirky. First of all, she only ate white bread and milk, only that, and she always chastised him when he ordered like steak. And he like drank wine and he smoked, and you know she used to tell him, you know, the human body is designed to last 200 years or something like that. But you, the way that you treat it, you know, that's why you guys age so rapidly, and something like that. And also that when they were making love, like she was totally not into it, you know, like only going to the emotions, almost like, not like Antonio Villas-Boas, because he is alien lover. I guess she was into it, but she grunted like a dog. But anyway, long story short, Benítez locates this Ricky B, and he really gets the impression that either she's some kind of like a schizophrenic maniac, or she's an alien walking. That she was an American tourist that suffered a very, very traumatic accident in Mexico, actually, in Tulum, here in Yucatan Peninsula. She was in a bus crash. And the idea that you get in the book is that that's the moment when this woman died or her soul departed, that some kind of like alien entity took possession of her body. And that's, you know, the story of Ricky B. And it's one like the Coneil case is very much unresolved. It's a lot of gaps, a lot of what ifs, but it is a fascinating case nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There is no such thing as closure with the subject ever.
Exactly.
So, man, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about this crazy, crazy case. So, what kind of projects do you have going on right now? I know, you know, the ufology tarot deck. How did you initially become involved in that?
Well, that will take another podcast. But the very, very summarized version of it is that my friend and mentor, Greg Bishop, invited me to this closed group that he put together with like-minded people, because he wanted to organize weekly salons, you know, via Skype. You know, not only to hang out and have a good time and discuss UFO topics, but also to try to do something concrete. Because Greg has always been of the idea that ufology benefits from working with small groups. The moment that you get big groups like MUFON or APRO and ICAP, that's when things get really nasty really quickly, or if not quickly, eventually. So then in one of those salons, Greg came up and said, hey, you know, I always have this idea that maybe we could create some kind of like tarot deck, but instead of the typical avatars of the tarot, we could use people or characters from the history mythology. And everybody said, oh my God, that is the greatest idea ever. And I almost think that he told me that idea beforehand in a private conversation between the two of us. So I already knew about that. So I encouraged it, but at the same time, I was kind of like resistant because I knew that the brunt of the work will fall into my shoulders because I was like the artist or the only artist in that group. And at first I was like saying, I don't know if I couldn't pull this off. I don't know if I have the time. I don't know if I have the skills. And they kept insisting and say, until I finally say, okay, fine, I'll try to do one, you know, and if it comes out horrible, that will be the end of it. And I created one and it wasn't that horrible. And the guy said, yeah, you can do it. And okay, I'll say, fine. And we tried to do it, in my quote unquote free time. For a couple of years until I realized, okay, this is going to take like a decade if we're going at this pace, because the tarot deck is kind of long. There are like 70 something, you know, cards involved. Mm-hmm. And it took me like 6 months to just to draw one puny little card. Like, okay, this is not going well. So then we decided, okay, maybe we can do some kind of like a crowdsourcing campaign, you know, to try to get the people involved, get the funds. Basically, the funds is for me so I can solely devote myself to draw these cards and do nothing else except, you know, the occasional podcast appearance like this one, and keep writing for the Daily Grail, which is the place where I started to become involved with the paranormal scene. And yeah, unfortunately for us, the response was better than we could have ever expected. We were funded beyond 200%, which is kind of like amazing. So yeah, right now that is going to be my life for here to November of 2022. That's going to be the thing that I'm going to dedicate almost all my waking time. Aside from, you know, going to the bathroom and such. And aside from that, yeah, I'll still try to keep writing for the Daily Grail, although I realize that I haven't put anything new in quite a while. I guess I'm aside from feeling drained from all these, the campaign and all that. There's not too much going on the UFO scene that inspires me right now, Rob, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. It's very dry and very bleak. And I know that if I'm going to write something, it's probably going to be an editorial rant. Maybe that's what I'm going to do maybe tomorrow or next Sunday, because I really am wary on the direction that the UFO scene, particularly in the United States, is heading. Mm-hmm. It's not looking good.
No, it's very stagnant. It kind of landed with a boom with the New York Times article, and I felt it was
with the release of that preliminary report in June. That was, I think, that what deflated this balloon for good. And right now, there are people trying to keep blowing on it. Occasionally, it kind of like gets a bump. The idea of this amendment by Senator Gillibrand, to have a new and improved UFO office. Oh, yeah. But then we have the bad UFO office that the Pentagon is putting on. Luis Elizondo says, no, that's a bad one. Boo, boo. This is not what we want. So this is this back and forth that honestly, I don't think not a lot of people understand. I don't understand it. I'm trying to read the legalese papers in these bills, and I can barely comprehend it. You know, you need people like Douglas Ian Johnson, who is someone who tweets on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I think he is a lawyer, I think, and he kind exactly. of like sums it up. He like chews it up and digest it for the benefit of us dumbasses. That's the only thing that's going on. And the Galileo project that I was very excited about it at the beginning, but right now it's starting to look like just another UFO project that tries to be quote-unquote scientific. I still wish them the best of luck. I know people that are involved in it that I care for, but it's not looking good. I mean, I don't understand why they need to have people like Elizondo and Mellon and Nick Pope. I don't know why Nick Pope is there with this scientist, but yeah, that's the UFO scene in late 2021.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In next week's episode, I had Chris Cogswell on, who was, you know, briefly a part of the Galileo project, and he voiced similar concerns in announcing his departure from it as well. So, yeah, it's you know, we'll see what 2022 has to offer. You know.
Disclosure.
Yeah. Give it to us. Give it to us, or give it to somebody, or whatever. So where can people follow your work? Because you have your writings with the Daily Grail. You also, you know, you have your art on you know, your website. So where can people follow along with what you have going on?
Yeah, my main page is absurdbydesign.com, and the name of that website, by the way, is something that I like took out from Jacques Vallée's writing. Mm-hmm. The idea that okay, these phenomenon UFOs, they are absurd, but maybe there is a method to the madness. Maybe they are absurd by design. So mm-hmm. I thought, I like that idea, especially if it is a site devoted mainly to art and design. So yeah, you can check out my art commissions, also the book covers that I have designed for friends that have to do with UFOs, like Saucers, Spooks, and Kooks. I think that we discussed it in this recording. Also, It Defies Language, which was the first cover that I made. UFOs Reframing the Debate. I'm still very proud of that one. Mm-hmm. And other ones. And yeah, and also you can find me. I'm very, very active on Twitter. It's like my favorite social media platform. I guess I'm also on Facebook. I have my Red Pill Junkie Facebook page there. But truth be told, I barely use it. So if you guys want to follow me on Twitter, I'm sure you will find me, and I respond to tweets, and I try to put not only things about UFOs, because that will be tiresome, but yeah, it's a fun platform.
It is. It really is. Thank you again for joining me for this episode. If you want to support what we do at the Our Strange Skies podcast, folks, please rate us and review us. It helps a lot. We also have a Patreon. The link will be in the description. And $3 a month, it'll get you this episode, which will be out on Monday. It'll get you this episode early. It'll be out on Patreon sometime tomorrow. But if you want bonus episodes, early releases, $3 a month over on Patreon. It's patreon.com/yourUFOguy. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO for the intro and outro to this program. And our logo was designed by the great Desdemona. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or in the skies of southern Spain. In gray we trust.
Media.